So, jetzt folgt in dieser Sendung über die Konferenz. In der Sendung über die Konferenz in Prag das Gespräch mit Eli Zaretsky. Eli Zaretsky ist Professor of History an der New School for Social Research in New York und einige seiner Bücher sind zum Beispiel Capitalism, the Family and Personal Life und Secrets of the Soul, a Social and Cultural History of Psychoanalysis. Und herausgegeben hat er zum Beispiel Polish Peasant in Europe and America bei William E. Thomas und Florian Zanetsky. Danach folgt direkt das Gespräch mit Johanna Mehan. Sie ist Professorin an der Brandeis University in und hat Forschungsinteressen, also ist ein Spezialist arbeitet über Habermas und unterrichtet Ethics, Social and Political Philosophy and Feminist Theory. So, jetzt.
Could you remember when you start thinking about trauma and traumatization?
I was a student at Brandeis University, which is a Jewish university in the United States, and many of my professors were Holocaust survivors, and it was directly their experiences as it came through in the classroom. I think that was the beginning of that series of reflections. But then, But then when I adopted a little girl from China, and she had suffered very, very badly. She was badly burned. She suffered from malnutrition and having to learn how to live with and love a child who was so badly damaged. That was when I began my own serious work on trauma and memory and intersubjective recognition.
Yeah. So you mentioned this university. How was the situation? Can you to represent this Holocaust research?
Well, it was a real privilege because most of the professors I had were the last generation of a set of German intellectuals who had escaped and in one way or another wound up teaching at Brandeis. And they were very educated in the traditions of German idealist philosophy and phenomenology and existentialism, and that's how I came to be a philosopher in the first place.
Studied philosophy?
Yes.
So, so for me it's not so clear the bridge between your own it's a better question is how do you work now? On what point of your work are you now in relation to your experience or having a child who is traumatized? Did you work with traumatized?
I was working as a philosopher on the project of subjectivity. I was working on Habermas. I worked in Germany for a while. I came to Frankfurt while Habermas was there. So my interest was on theorizing a conception of the self. And it seemed to me that a fair amount of the work on the self did not take seriously the dimension of intersubjectivity and infancy. So then I started working on that, and one of the things that became very clear to me was that you couldn't give an account of trauma as a developmental account of a happy childhood produces untraumatized people, because what you have are social political conditions that create situations of trauma. So that to say, well, it happens in childhood is not a right account. So that I wanted to look at what happens in childhood and then what gets undone in the moment of trauma. So that's how the two pieces of my work came together. Raising a child who had been badly traumatized led me to think about the way in which the early formation of the self is involved. But the work on the Holocaust made very clear that trauma can undo subjectivity at any point in time, not just in childhood.
Yeah.
So that's how...
The American Christian. The American.
Could you remember? Could you remember when you started to think about psychoanalysis? The time when you
said I was very young when I began to think about psychoanalysis, like in my teens.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, it was such a powerful. I mean, Freud was such a powerful figure, sort of like Dostoevsky or Goethe or Leonardo, and it really was the deepest philosophy of that age in terms of thinking about basic questions. So when I became an adolescent, it was a very normal thing that you would get interested in psychoanalysis, and I did. And then I got interested again in the 1960s when it was linked by Marcuse and Norman O. Brown and so forth, was linked it to the student movements. Those were some of the early origins of my interest in psychoanalysis.
Yeah. So the situation, if you maybe remember the situation when you started to work more on capitalism?
I worked on capitalism before I worked on psychoanalysis, and I wrote a book called Capitalism, the Family and Personal Life, which is an historical analysis of the emergence of the public-private split, and which I traced to industrialization. This was in the early 70s, where it was kind of a commonplace idea now, but that was an original idea at that point. And when I was very interested, and to remain very interested, in understanding the family and family relations, and gender relations, and sexual relations, and so forth, in relationship to capitalism, when I finished that book, I felt that the one thing that I had not accounted for, was not able to account for through a kind of more or less Marxist, somewhat Marxist historical account. They were really not Marxist, was very influenced by the emergence of the women's movement, but it was still, I was still very influenced by Marx. I felt that there were still new issues that arose from that psychoanalysis brought up, which I had not been able to think about historically. And I had never studied psychoanalysis systematically. And Juliet Mitchell's book, Psychoanalysis and Feminism, just came out at around that time, 1974. And I read that book and decided to review it, which I did, but in the course of reviewing it, I realized that I would have to learn more about psychoanalysis to review it properly. I wound up reading the whole of Freud because he's a very, very wonderful writer, very, very engaging, very powerful. I started to read it chronologically, since I'm an historian. I started at the beginning and so forth. And at first, I thought, oh, you know, this really doesn't make any sense, and I was arguing against it and so forth. But the more I read, the more deeply I became involved with it, and the more convincing I found it.
Yeah. So when you, yeah, maybe you could say something more when you started to read Freud.
Yeah.
How it was.
Well, I was reading it in a hospital. I was reading it in a library. I was not an academic at that point. I was editing a political journal, and so I didn't have an academic library. And I was reading the standard edition in a medical hospital.
Yeah.
I would go there every day and sit there and read it. And as I say, I was looking for more social explanation.
Yeah.
And so I would read these things in Freud, and I always think, well, where's the society? Where's the social relations? Where's the surrounding culture? And these kinds of things. But the more that I read Freud, the more I realized, well, that's not what he's about. But that the what he is about, namely what goes on in individuals, that itself is already social. The fact that the that what goes on in inside individuals and understanding what goes on in inside individuals cannot be, in a sense, recuperated back into the society and culture, cannot be sort of explained through what is going on in the society and culture at that point to in relationship to that individual, even though, of course, there are all sorts of connections and relationships and so forth, but they can't be mapped onto one another, that was itself a social and historical fact, that that was a new fact in history, and that became sort of one of my main ideas in my book.
Yeah, and at what point are you now in your work?
Well, I wrote this book called Secrets of the Soul, A Social and Cultural History of Psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
And it's coming out in German.
Yeah.
In about a year, it's come out in English and so forth. But I'm still working on the question of psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
I'm writing five essays now, which are mostly finished, which are, one is concerned with psychoanalysis and the spirit of capitalism, three of them are concerned with psychoanalysis and various groups of people. The groups are Jews, African Americans, and women. Each has a very distinctive history in relationship to psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
The place that psychoanalysis occupies in the history of the Jews in the modern Jewish attempts to deal with what it means to be a Jew and so forth, and African Americans, especially the work of Richard Wright, who was very influenced by psychoanalysis and very important in African American history, especially in legitimizing certain experiences of negativity and aggression and so forth that had really not been had not really been fully expressed within African American culture before.
Yeah.
And then women, of course, I think psychoanalysis represents an alternative to feminism in terms of its understanding of gender.
Yeah.
Psychoanalysis, what psychoanalysis did with gender was to take the previous explanation according to this is what a man is and this is what a woman is, and he rejected that.
Mm.
And it redefined what people are in terms of, basically, in terms of object choice. That is, it redefined becoming a man in terms of making a choice of a woman, working out the evolution of your sexuality, which in early childhood is very mixed and diverse and so forth, comes to be organized around an object choice. And the same thing for a woman, her sexuality, which is very mixed and so forth, and you don't have really distinctions, comes to be focused on making a choice normally of a man. And then, but obviously in both cases, there's other kinds of object choices, and this is what Freud meant by bisexuality. No one just chooses a man as an object or chooses a woman as an object. Everybody chooses both and identifies with both. And that was one alternative, one way of understanding gender. And I think feminism has its own way of, or its own ways of understanding gender, and they critiqued it, so I'm writing about that.
Yeah.
And also I'm writing an article about the 1960s, the role of psychoanalysis in the 1960s.
Okay.
So these are the five essays that I'm working on now.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, jetzt folgt Nancy Fraser, die gerade hier in Frankfurt, denke ich, bekannt ist über ihre Arbeiten zu Social and Political Theory und Feminist Theory und auch über die Debatte mit Axel Honneth, Politics of Redistribution and Recognition, sozusagen als zu verstehen als eine Form, dass die Politics of Representation eigentlich neu gedacht werden müssen. In Prag hat Nancy Fraser einen Vortrag gehalten, und zwar mit dem Titel Reframing Justice in a Globalizing World, und sie wird jetzt auch am 15. Juni in Frankfurt einen Vortrag halten. Das kann man auch in der Universität hier erfahren.
Remember the time when you started to think about justice?
Well, I mean, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, which was in the near south of the United States. And when I was growing up, it was a legally segregated city, racially segregated. So when I was in junior high and high school, the struggle for desegregation was unfolding, and I became very involved in it, and I think that was probably the first, you know, really striking, concrete experience of learning about injustice and justice. And I was a student radical later in the anti-Vietnam War movement, and then of course a feminist and concerned with injustices of gender, and so it's been a lifelong concern going back to when I was quite young.
Yeah, you mentioned that you were in a situation where segregation was material.
Yes, and legally enforced, yes.
Can you tell me something about it more?
Oh, well, in the EU, African Americans were not allowed to eat in restaurants. They couldn't go into swimming pools in the city, in the public. They couldn't go to amusement parks where you would have, you know, these various rides and things. They couldn't stay in hotels. They were only separate and very inferior places where they could go. And I have one very clear memory. We had a black woman who worked in our house as a maid and a cook, and we went on a vacation, and she came with us, and we stopped in the car. We were in the car, and we stopped to eat, and I remember that we had to bring food out to her. She wasn't allowed to go into the restaurant. So that's what it's kind of astounding, but to think about this today. But this was only as recently as the 1960s. This was the case in the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when could you tell me when about the time when you started to think more about feminist philosophy?
Well, I became very involved in feminism as like many women of my generation in the New Left, and finding that the gender relations were not egalitarian enough, and because we were so conscious about problems of equality and injustice, we naturally applied them to gender too. So we began to have a kind of a critique of the gender relations in the New Left. And at this point, I wasn't really doing philosophy. When I finished my undergraduate degree at the university, I was very involved in political activism, and I didn't think that I wanted to do any graduate work. I wanted to do activism. So that was the period in which I started to become quite involved in feminism. Later, after about 5 years, I went back to the university to get my PhD in philosophy. And at that time, I began to try to start to think philosophically about the issues that I had been involved with on an activist basis earlier.
Yeah. So from this activist basis, how does it, can you make a kind of line to the current discussions?
I think it's somewhat harder to...
Axel Honneth and you on this...
I think it's somewhat harder to relate theory and practice today, actually, because in the period I was talking about earlier, we had, you know, mobilized student... well, social movements that were growing, that were full of energy, that and full of optimism about changing the world. I don't think that's the situation today. I think that we are... It's a darker time. I think there's much less optimism that we can really change things. I think social movements are more ephemeral. There are this demonstration or that demonstration, but they don't have an ongoing life of discussing and really trying to analyze things and so on. So for me, it's been a time to sort of try to step back and understand how we got into this, I think, more difficult and dark time after a period that in the 70s that seemed to be a very progressive time where change was possible. How did those possibilities get closed off and so on?
I'm a lecture on last Thursday, Reframing Justice in a Globalizing World.
Yes.
What were the because I
yes.
missed it.
Oh, well, I was really talking about the way in which in the post-war period it was for the most part taken for granted that the modern territorial state was the unit in which we tried to work out problems of justice, so that it was the fellow citizens who were the ones who deserved to be taken into account, and how today globalization has problematized that. We don't any longer know what the right frame is. We can't any longer take for granted that it's always the modern territorial state. So I was talking about this problem of the frame.
Okay.
All right.
Nach Nancy Fraser folgt jetzt Robert Fine. Robert Fine ist in Warwick, Coventry, als Chair of the Department and Convener of the MA in Social and Political Thought. Seine Bücher beinhalten Demokratie und Rule of, also und Regeln des Rechts, könnte man sagen, Untersuchungen und Arbeiten über Hegel, Marx, Arendt und about, also Cosmo Labor and Liberation in South Africa, und er hat mit herausgegeben Social Theory After the Holocaust, People, Nation and State and Policing the Miners' Strikes and Capitalism and the Rule of Law. Befragt habe ich ihn zu dem, wie er jetzt über Cosmopolitanism arbeitet. The time when you started to think about cosmopolitanism?
Yes. Well, I had finished a book on South Africa, which had nothing to do with cosmopolitanism at all. But the book was on the labor movement in South Africa and the relation of the labor movement to nationalism. And what I was arguing is that the tendency within the South African literature to treat nationalism, African nationalism, or some kind of black nationalism, as the only form of legitimate opposition to apartheid was belied by a history of labour politics also struggling against forms of racism and Afrikaner nationalism. So I was interested in that, and that was part of a broader interest in non-nationalist ways of thinking.
Yeah.
And then when I first came across Kant's writings on cosmopolitanism, of cosmopolitanism, I thought, well, this is interesting because it shows that the tradition of cosmopolitan thinking is as old as the tradition of nationalism. And has been, in a sense, they've been their coeval ways of thinking.
Yeah.
So I got it. I thought that was interesting, and
yeah,
it's always disturbed me the extent to which national ways of thinking have taken over our imagination.
Yeah.
So that's when I got into literature on cosmopolitanism.
Yeah.
Do you want a date?
you mentioned South Africa at the time.
I was doing that work in the 1990s.
Yeah. And how could you explain why you had been in South Africa for that research or for that?
Well, I was interested in South Africa. I was interested in forms of anti-racism.
Yeah.
And South Africa had, at that time, a very active independent trade union movement.
Yeah.
Which developed very open and inclusive forms of anti-racism. Very exciting, kind of bottom-up forms of anti-racism. And I was sort of wary of ways of thinking that sort of responded to one nationalism with another nationalism. And I found the labour movement there, the independent trade union movement, very exciting, very, very kind of positive. And so, you know, it was a good case in, I mean, there was no special reason, it was just a very good case in point.
Okay. And do you know Ulrich Beck's...
I do. Very well.
Because he had this definition of the cosmopolitan in the third, during the Second World War. And then if you call someone a cosmopolitan, then it meant that he has to go to hell. Like, Christians were identified as cosmopolitans. So this is really kind of negative notion.
Well,
now it's changed, I think.
That was another reason I was drawn to the literature on cosmopolitanism.
Yeah.
Because I thought, you know, if the Stalinists denigrated the rootless cosmopolitan Jew.
Yeah.
Then there must be something good in cosmopolitanism. So, you know, there was a kind of... I identified.
Yeah.
I thought, well, it must have something going for it.
Okay. And at what point are you now with your... thinking on cosmopolitanism?
I think now I'm I think the general kind of stance I've got is I'm interested in the idea of cosmopolitan judgment, and I don't see I don't think I've ever seen cosmopolitanism as a kind of ideal, an ism. I don't really like the sort of ism of cosmopolitanism.
Yeah.
You know, one time you're a socialism and then there's cosmopolitanism. And
yes.
I'm rather wary of any of these isms. And I think that if you treat it as a kind of abstract ideal, it doesn't allow you to reach any interesting conclusions.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in developing it as a form of judgment, a form of a way of doing political life, rather than a set of formulae. And I'm a little bit concerned that it's become a set of formulae.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think I see cosmopolitanism as a kind of research project.
Yeah.
And Beck has been very important in sort of generating that research project. And it's a very open-ended one and a long way to go. And I see myself as part of, you know, much broader, much wider sort of
yeah.
collective research project.
Mit John Zorn leiten wir über jetzt zu Christopher Cern. Und zwar arbeitet Christopher Cern aktuell über Deliberative Democracy and Constitutionalism und hat zum Beispiel auch über Balkanization, Societal Homogenization gearbeitet, über Fraser's Conception of Social Justice und darüber, wie man das Dilemma mit Honneth's Integrative Theory Redistribution and Democracy Recognition lösen kann. Also jetzt noch zum Schluss. Christopher Cern.
When could you remember the time when you started to think about deliberative democracy?
I started to think about deliberative democracy as a topic, I think. Probably in the late 80s. Of course, Habermas's work was a formative influence here, and as a graduate student I was studying that, and Fechtesität und Geltung had come out in German.
Yeah.
And working with Tom McCarthy, who is my dissertation advisor, I had access to that kind of discussion, and so got interested in it more from a socio-theoretic than a political theoretic perspective. That is to say, my interests were not at first what makes democracy legitimate, but how do we understand the social processes and especially transformations characteristic of modern capitalism and contemporary capitalism in particular. And Habermas seemed to have a kind of interesting story about the role of law in that. And I started thinking more and more about those issues.
Yeah, more about law issues.
Yeah, more about law issues. And in particular, my current project is trying to think about how or what role constitutional review plays in deliberative democracy. And I actually have a very specific time when this interest occurred. I was teaching a seminar at Ohio University on Between Facts and Norms, Fechtesität und Geltung, and a colleague of mine was sitting in one day and asked this relatively innocent objection, I thought, and it drove me crazy because I simply couldn't answer the objection. I couldn't figure out how Habermas would answer it. I couldn't figure out how A general theory of deliberative democracy would answer the objection. And so, unfortunately, or fortunately, I started on this enormous research project of trying to think about different ways of institutionalizing the function of constitutional review and how that goes together or doesn't with a general deliberative democratic vision of political legitimacy.
Yeah. And what could you say more about how would you about the state of deliberative democracy now in your project?
As a theory or as
as a theory or as a condition?
I mean, in my project, I take it as the most convincing normative account of democracy. But it's convincing not just on sort of pure normative terms alone, that is not in terms of pure political theory, but precisely because it at least has some, I think, empirical relevance. That is to say, we can see features of current political systems that are well characterized by the theory of deliberative democracy. So I take it that it's one of the, say, three or four main competing paradigms of democracy, one that I find, as I say, normatively attractive and somewhat empirically useful. And now I'm trying to use it to do something that hasn't been done yet as much in the literature, and that is to say doing sort of more applied institutional design, the sort of questions that, you know, political scientists are inevitably quite interested in, but approach from a different direction.
Yeah. And could you say more about the situation in Prague when you had this lecture about deliberative democracy and the constitutional review and the institutions of constitutional review?
Yeah.
How was the discussion or the situation for you there?
The discussion was, some of this is from the particularities of my presentation there and where it goes in my research. What I presented there was the final substantive chapter of a quite long book. So some questions and concerns obviously were the kinds of things that I say, oh yeah, I try and answer that in chapter 3, or oh yeah, see chapter 6. But some of the questions were really quite helpful, precisely because the trick in thinking about deliberative democracy is to neither prioritize the ideal nor the real. That is to say, to get the right mix of normative components from sort of pure political theory and the right mix of realistic assessments of capacities of institutions given what we know about how actual political systems work. And from that direction, the folks who come to Prague are particularly helpful in thinking about some of the actual impediments to realizing deliberative democratic ideals in the world as we know it.
Yeah. And here in your book you are saying political philosophy then plays a crucial role in justifying the function of constitutional review in terms of its fundamental role in a well-functioning democracy. But poor normative theory alone is insufficient to settle question about how best to design institutions for constitutional review. So, could you say more broadly about how constitutional review plays this role in a well-functioning democracy?
The short answer is, I hope I can make this short. Legitimate deliberative democracy is constitutional democracy. That is to say, there has to be some distinction between higher law and ordinary law, or entrenched law and ordinary law, precisely because what warrants the legitimacy of the outcomes of whatever democratic processes we have. So we take a vote or we have a parliament do something. What makes it expectable to the ordinary citizen that that's an okay outcome, even when that citizen disagrees with the substantive outcome? And that substantive outcome is going to be, as it were, enforced upon citizens through the coercive of monopoly of the state. What warrants the legitimacy claim of those outcomes, I think, are the reliability of the procedures that lead to that. Now, if you have a constitution that says that there's higher law over ordinary law, then the problem is simply this. No organ of government has, as it were, from pure normative grounds, the legitimate claim to say what the Constitution means.
Yeah.
That is ultimately part of the constituent power of the people, collected as a constituent power. Now, of course, we know from Rousseau on that that's an impossible thing to actually do. That is, it's impossible to have, say, a collection of, in my homeland, 300 million people getting together and having a decent deliberation about what the particular procedures are that are going to structure democracy.
Yeah.
So right then, you have a serious conflict between the ideals of constitutionally structured democracy and how you can implement it in practice.
Yeah.
There are additional complexities and ramifications and stuff like that, especially concerned with the sort of path dependence of legal developments. I mean, once you choose the legal mode, you have to take along some of the good parts and the bad parts of that way of regulating our common life together. So then it seems to me that, as it were, sort of pure normative political theory putters out here.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is try and think about what the various kinds of ideals you want to serve in your institutional design are, and see whether or not you can actually realize them in different institutions. And from an academic perspective or from a scholarship perspective, that means taking seriously the results of comparative law.
Yeah.
And here's where we get to just a sort of sociological problem with current scholarship. That is to say, it's mostly nation-state specific.
Yeah. And would you say that that the public or the public spheres should play another role or a better role for this kind of...
Yes. It's probably some of my most radical institutional recommendations.
To make it more complex, but to have a complexity probably for this problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think that... I mean, let me try and be simple here. One of the neat innovations of Habermas's theory is that he doesn't pay attention simply to the formal organs of government, that is, the standard branches of a national government, you know, organized over, if you have a federalist system, some kind of division of powers between the central state and the regional authorities. That's the sort of traditional place of looking at the public sphere. But one of Habermas's great innovations, I think, is to introduce a sort of two-track notion of politics, that is to say, the political decisions of that formal sphere of politics are only legitimate if they, in some sense, work up and express what is detected, worried about, struggled over, and discussed in the much broader, anarchic, informal, what he calls weak public spheres of radio, TV, scholarly discussion, everyday discussion, coffee houses, yada, 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 yada. The whole story of wild and anarchic civil society, as it were.
Yeah. Okay, am Mikrofon verabschiede sich jetzt Felicia Herrschaft und wir machen am 13.06. dann eine Sendung über die Biennalen, die gerade in Prag und Venedig laufen, und die Gespräche mit den Philosophen setzen wir fort, gerade weil auch Christopher Stern noch sehr interessant über die europäische Verfassung gesprochen hat. Okay, bis dann. Danke, ciao.